on the Empire Podcast. This week, we get all paranoid with Simon Pegg and Crispian Mills, who drop in to talk about a fantastic fear of everything. Bob Whitey swings by to natter about Woody Allen, and we discuss the latest films and the latest film news, as you might expect on this, the only film podcast that has a terrible cold and really shouldn't be here, but should be in bed instead. Hello everyone, I'm Chris Hewitt, or should it be, hello everyone, I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast, a jam-packed jamboree celebrating all things filmic. It's a bit like the Jubilee concert, only we can promise you that Gary Barlow won't be showing up here. Oh no, we've bolted the doors and bricked up the windows just to be on the safe side. But before we did that, three of Empire's finest writers snuck in ready to tackle the week's big movie stories. As ever, I'm joined by our resident Northern Irish firebrand, the movie world's equivalent of the Reverend Dr. Ian Paisley. Helen O'Hara, how are you?
I object to that categorisation as strongly as it is possible to object to anything.
That's a lot.
John Hume, I will accept, maybe. But, we're going to get political if we keep going on like this.
We are
Hello, Chris, how do you do?
I'm doing fine, Helen, how are you? Hi, now, Brian Kai. Was that an Northern Irish accent you were doing there, James,
yes,
by the way?
Yes, it was. Well, it was an attempt.
It was very good. I enjoyed it very much. And that was James, who is our very own Jason Statham lookalike. By which I mean he's bald and doesn't shave, and as you can tell, the effect is slightly spoiled when he opens his mouth. It is, of course, James Dyer.
Delighted to be here, dear boy.
Oh, dear God. Oh, Lord. Okay, we've set a good standard here. And finally, making his Empire Pod debut is an Empire legend, a man whose very name is synonymous with quality, a man who is the world's leading authority on Steven Spielberg, a man who has met, much to my chagrin, the entire cast of Event Horizon, a man who is very simply Ian Freer. Welcome, sir.
Hey Chris, how you doing?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm good, I feel a bit like Tony Slattery when he went on Whose Line Is It Anyway? You know, these giants like Mockery and Proops and Styles, and I'm just a new boy, so I feel a bit...
Can I be Ryan Styles?
You could be Ryan Styles.
You're going to push my head down the toilet and do me a wedgie, aren't you?
Slattery was very good on Whose Line Is It Anyway? That's what brought him to attention. I think that's what made him the host of Saturday Night at the Movies. Do you remember that? Do you remember that show?
I did, yeah.
What did you make of Saturday Night at the Movies on ITV?
Piss poor.
As indeed is most things in Tony Slattery's career. Poor guy. I know. But anyway, delighted to have you in. Lots of people have been requesting your presence on the podcast over the last few weeks. Mainly the same person, it has to be said. But
okay,
well, Piccolo135 will be delighted to see that you're here.
Fantastic. Hello, Dan.
Indeed. If you want to get in touch with us, it's very, very simple. Tweet the hell out of us at Empire Magazine using hash Empire Podcast as a hashtag. You can Facebook us, although not many people seem to get in touch with us via Facebook. It feels a little bit left out.
Aww.
Poor old Mark Zuckerberg and his billions. And you can, of course, email us via podcast@empireonline.com, which is where this week's first missive comes from, actually. Dallas King, who is a former workie, he asks, has anyone here rewatched Prometheus, and how have their opinions changed on it? Has anyone here seen it twice?
Not yet. I might see it twice, I think. Because I went afterwards, and I was out with Ollie Richards, formerly of this parish, and Ollie Moss and people, and we were sitting chatting about
name
it.
Drop.
Yeah, I know. It's good, isn't it? And we were sitting chatting about it, and I realised that it had maybe made more sense on reflection than I gave it credit for first time around. That said, I still think the characters are lacking, and, you know, there are some things that just don't hang together. Mm-hmm. But I will give it another go just to make sure.
I just like the fact that we had a question about aliens sent in by somebody called Dallas.
Very good.
And he didn't even have to change his name. There we go. There's a lot of people contacting us on Twitter saying that we should have disassociated ourselves mentally from Alien going into Prometheus. Now that's not impossible, isn't it?
Can you? It's so full of alien
DNA.
DNA, yeah, indeed. So I think, you know, you have to judge it on some level on those terms.
I think if Ridley Scott wasn't connected with this film, then maybe you could go, okay, I'm not going to think of Alien, but the very fact that he is.
But even then, I think they bent over backwards to get sort of the same beats in there. There's the, you know, chest hugger equivalent. There's the alien equivalent.
Facehugger,
chest burster equivalents. You know, even before you get to...
Yeah, true.
You know, towards the end of the movie. And I think... It's all in there, and that for me was one of the big weaknesses. I really liked all the kind of big meta god stuff. I'm a big fan of my sci-fi, so I liked all of that, but I felt like they kind of didn't get, go into that as much as they could have because they were too busy hitting all those alien beats. Mm. So I think it's completely legitimate, to be honest, to talk about it.
Absolutely, even down to introducing the ship Prometheus with those captions, very much like the Nostromo back in the first
Well, association with Alien is kind of the biggest flaw with Prometheus. If you took it on its own, actually, I think there's a lot to recommend it. I mean, there's a lot of problems, don't get me wrong. But yeah, comparing
but
it to Alien
does
kind of
But would there be so much interest in it if it didn't have the connection to Alien? Would we be so excited about it?
No, probably not, and that would have helped it as well.
Absolutely. I don't know what we've concluded there, Dallas. But no, we haven't rewatched it. I actually am going to rewatch it tonight, via Orange Wednesdays. So if anyone can give me a free Orange Wednesdays, is that how this works?
This isn't live on a Friday. What?
This is obviously live on a Friday. Shit. Anyway, moving swiftly on. Jimmy Pattinson, who's no relation to Rob, I trust. By the way, if I do say Orange Wednesdays in this, do they get free stuff, don't you, when you mention things?
I don't imagine you do.
You were on an Orange podcast and you didn't get free.
That is very true. Yeah, because I am an Orange customer, so you know, some free calls would be amazing, or some free texts. Anything, I'll take anything. Jimmy Pattinson, no relation to Rob, I trust, emails in with a doozy related to one of our jingles, one of our ancient jingles from a show that's 2 months old. Anyway, he says, I've heard a rumor they're making a sequel to Battleship. Okay. Uh-huh. Apparently, it's going to be called Pearl Harbor, or U571.
E-W-E.
He says, please don't hate me. It took me about 6 weeks to come up with those, and I'm very proud of him.
He is, of course, incorrect. The sequel is, of course, Lambusters.
No, it's the Thin Red Ovine.
Oh,
or Enemy at the Ungulates.
Or Apocalypse Cow, or something like that. Who knows?
Shearing Private Ryan.
That's my favourite.
There is a freer podcast magic. It's already coming through. Martin Hennessy emailed in to take Helen to task for not liking Love Actually, pointing out that many of her criticisms, like an ensemble cast that doesn't quite work, disparate stories that aren't really given time to develop, also apply to the Avengers.
Not so.
Ah.
Not so.
Really?
No.
Okay.
You're a Love Actually hater, aren't you, Helen?
I'm not a hater. I'm just I don't know. It would have worked better as, you know, 19 different films.
See, it's actually one of my favourite Christmas movies.
You're an idiot.
Yeah, obviously, well, after Die Hard.
Obviously.
Mm.
There's a double bill.
Yes. I really like it.
But The Avengers just has one story, and it deals well with its characters.
How are we comparing these two films?
It outsourced its character development to several other films. Anyway, I'll stop.
I've literally no idea what's going on. Ian, where do you stand in Love, Actually?
It was too gritty for me. It was just too tough. It's got a great scene with Emma Thompson.
It does. Yeah, she's
fantastic,
terrific.
Fantastic, heartbreaking
scene. Finds out that Alan Rickman's cheating on her.
Terrific.
There's some really lovely moments in there.
Great moments.
Yeah. I want to see Richard Curtis's The Avengers. That's a film to watch.
Yeah.
I think you're pretty much alone in that one. Martin Hennessy also had a point, but I think it's probably a bit moot by now. He says, Hugh Grant would make a great Hulk.
No, that's
silly. I can't see that.
All the way.
Yeah, okay. Via Twitter, @Lef, I think I pronounced your name right, L-L-E-F, if you want to follow her. She said she had a Nolan-a-thon this weekend. She read the latest mag, plus watched Memento, Prestige, which is a great film, and Nolan's Bat films. And she was wondering how we see a Nolan Bond going, if Chris Nolan could ever tackle James Bond and how that would go.
Well, I think it'd be very much in the Sean Connery mould as opposed to the Roger Moore mould. I can't imagine being pigeons doing double takes and gondolas going across Venice Square.
Wouldn't you love it if suddenly after three po-faced Batman movies he turned out to actually love the Roger Moore movies?
Double entendre.
Miss Funny Fanny and all that. You know, like he got Russ Abbott back.
Yeah. But he'd do a terrific job, wouldn't he? It'd be epic and it'd have swagger and it'd have class and he'd be
absolutely
a brilliant choice.
Yeah.
Because the last reel of Inception is a James Bond movie, isn't it, to some degree?
Well, I've always said Batman Begins is a Bond movie. You have the different tiers of bad guys like you would have in a Bond film. You have these massive, you know, not huge Ken Adams style production design, but you have Lucius Fox is very much the Q role. Michael Caine is very much M. I think he's definitely worked it in. Bruce Wayne is a little bit Bondian at times in that one.
And Helen, as this podcast resident Bond hater, what would you feel about a Chris Nolan Bond movie?
I'd be open to it. You know, I quite liked Casino Royale. I'm sure I'll see Sam Mendes' effort at the same.
I'm sure at some point.
You're
withering.
I would go see a Chris Nolan Bond, but I always go see them. It's partly my job. The character underwhelms me. I don't care about Bond.
You hide it well.
Yeah, I'm pretty subtle.
Chris Nolan's actually one of the few directors who could actually play Bond. he's the right age. Yes.
Isn't he top
good looking guy?
The directors we would shag this, isn't
well,
he?
No,
top we, of this?
No, this is a feature that Chris and I have been discussing for about 8 years
eight
at this
years,
point.
Yeah. Fit directors.
Fit directors. One day we will write that feature.
Well, perhaps we can send him some suggestions, gets the listeners to send him some suggestions.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So this is just so Helen can swoon over Zack Snyder, isn't it, really?
It's not, but he was the one who prompted it, but it's not a me thing.
Absolutely. And can we just be absolutely clear here? If you are going to send in suggestions for fit directors, and please do use the hashtag fit directors, that would be great. It's not actors turn directors because they have a head start. So it's not Robert Redford. It's not Kevin Costner. These guys are good looking anyway. That's why they're actors.
Yes,
no
they can. They, I mean, they can have maybe had a role at some point in ancient history, but they should not be actors.
Yes.
Peter Berg even doesn't count. You know, Ben Affleck definitely doesn't count. But say Zack Snyder is okay.
At Katie Trainer declares, I have a rule about not watching any film starring hard man Danny Dyer. Do you have any similar rules?
That self-same rule.
Yes, indeed.
I have a different rule. I have a rule that I will only watch films where the budget is over $175 million. Because that actually buys you, that level of budget buys you
Danny Dyer.
It buys you entertainment value. Whatever else you say about the film, you know, John Carter, whatever you think of it, has some entertaining elements because it costs over $175 million.
Surely the entertainment of that film was that it cost over $175 million.
We disagree about that, James. I think it's got some strong things in it.
I agree with
Ian. Yeah, James, you're pretty much on your own.
Oh, it's dreadful. What are you talking about?
The old John Carter anti-bandwagon. Ian is, of course, joking.
I should point out.
To point right in, he is kidding. James, do you have a rule?
I should point out, first of all, I'm in no way related to Danny Dyer. I think it's important to get that on there.
I think people just can hear you and figure it out.
Really?
To be honest.
Because I don't end every sentence with bruv.
Yes, you're mugging me off.
Yeah, indeed.
Fair enough. So
moving on.
Do you have a rule?
Do I have a rule? Mm. A general rule?
Anyone you avoid?
God, the list is endless, I'll be honest with you. I can't think of nothing off the top of my head.
I love
the list is endless, but I can think of nothing on the list.
It's endless
to the point where it's infinite.
Yes, 10 minutes of silence. Yeah. And the last question for this week is from at Aris Heroes. Or is that Irish Heroes? I can't quite figure it out. Anyway, they ask, what actors have surprised you when playing roles they don't normally go for? I liked Will Ferrell in Stranger Than Fiction.
I also liked Will Ferrell in Stranger Than Fiction. Mm. And maybe something like, I don't know, I'm thinking Punch Drunk Love as well. And
Adam Sandler.
Paul Thomas Anderson, a genius, isn't he? Tom Cruise in Magnolia is something different for what he can do.
Tarantino's good at it as well. Yeah. Takes people, you know, plays him against type.
Rodney Dangerfield in Natural Born Killers.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a strange one, but
and I saw Moonrise Kingdom at the weekend. I thought that's really something interesting with Bruce Willis. It's a really different performance for him.
I love when Bruce Willis plays against Bruce Willis type. Yeah. Nobody's Fool and movies like that. The Paul Newman Robert Benton film. Do you remember?
Yeah, absolutely.
He's fantastic.
Also that Michael Cera film. You know, the one where he plays a slightly awkward geek. that was pretty impressive.
And to big up the women, I'd say we're going to be talking about Woody Allen later. But I thought. Mia Farrow in Broadway with Annie Rose is astonishing.
She's great.
Nothing like what Mia Farrow you've seen before. It's an amazing performance.
Fantastic. And that is it from our ever bulging mailbox for another week. Very disappointed the lack of jingles this week. We need you to write a 10 to 15 second jingle or sting for the podcast. To inspire you, here's one from the archives. This one is from Max Rosehill and the Blue Crooks. So there you go. If you want to write a jingle along similar lines or just go nuts, then write it and send it in to us as an MP3 to podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, time for some movie news. I thought the world had stopped to celebrate the Diamond Jubilee, but movie news waiteth for no queen. So Helen, let's start with you. What's on your movie mind?
Well, I thought I was excited and not at all surprised this morning to see that a writer has been hired to write a Justice League movie.
No.
I know.
Get out of town.
I know. Can you believe it?
Okay.
That writer is Will Beale, who is currently very much in favour over at Warner Brothers. Uh-huh. He turned in the script for Gangster Squad, which is, of course, been shooting, due out later this year.
Yes.
And also has been writing the reboot of Lethal Weapon and the remake of Logan's Run.
I'm with Chris.
Okay.
Well, you know...
Burn him.
It's not his fault that they're planning to make those films.
I wouldn't burn him, James, but I would maybe strongly oppose rewriting Lethal Weapon.
It's not his fault that they're making those films,
that's
but
true.
Let's just hope he's doing them well.
Yes, that's hope.
So he's obviously in favour. This is obviously another big step you know.
So this is DC doing what they should have done.
So is this partly because Batman is finishing and they can now reboot that character as a younger, and is that how this works?
I guess that's part of it. I mean, obviously, Justice League, for those of you who aren't comic nerds,
DC's Avengers, isn't it?
It's DC's Avengers. Mm. It's the super group of DC. So
of course, I'm going to be a super pedantic. Avengers was Marvel's Justice League, but anyway, that's
yes. But in film terms,
in film terms,
Marvel got there first, so DC is following up, and we've got Superman's in there. I mean, like the Avengers, it has a slightly changeable lineup, but you've got Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, The Flash,
Aquaman,
Green Lantern,
Martian Manhunter,
exactly.
But Huey, Dewey, Cuthbert, they're all in there. Ian, you're not a huge comic book fan,
no,
are you?
No, but I think it's interesting to see if they do learn the lessons from the Avengers, which it seems to me is that you absolutely have to super serve your fan base. You have to get that right. And once you get that right, and one of the things the Avengers did, it got great reviews across the board. The Guardian readers loved the Avengers. Everybody loves the Avengers. So I think, you know, you have to be very careful about making sure the fans are happy, yet making it have other things about it that people who are not so comic book minded will find in it.
Absolutely. Yeah. But of course, one thing Avengers did right, and this will please Amedee Bodega no end, because we're talking about it yet again, is that it seeded the movie.
Yes.
It started off, obviously,
it's got 12 hours of exposition, doesn't it?
Had 12 hours of exposition, 12 hours of backstory, where we met Captain America, Hulk, and Thor, and Iron Man, and the other ones as well. Is Justice League, Helen, as far as you're aware, still going to be very much a self-contained movie, and then might spin off a Flash movie or an Aquaman movie or...
Yeah, as far as they're talking about at the moment, they're talking about, you know, the Justice League. They're not talking about, we've got this overarching plan and we're going to introduce Wonder Woman and the Flash and all the rest. So they are talking about, you know, working from the inside outwards, which, if you like, is kind of what they tried to do with X-Men. You know, they were trying to spin off Wolverine. They were talking about spinning off Magneto, which hasn't happened. So it could, in theory, work. I have slight reservations. I'm personally a Marvel girl, not a DC girl, and I think one of the reasons why is that the DC characters are kind of godlike to begin with the exception, notably, of Batman. It's very, very, very hard to come up with something that Superman has trouble with. Coming up with something that's so, you know, overwhelmingly difficult to deal with that Superman has to call in Wonder Woman, who's also got godlike powers, and all the rest.
Yes. The irony, of course, being that one of the Avengers is, in fact, a god.
Yeah, and yet doesn't feel as godlike. Go figure.
Well, he's not. He's not. He's not quite on the Superman level, is old Thor. But,
well, he's just got what he has his powers. They don't sort of, you know, throw new ones at him occasionally. No,
this is the true. Man has a hammer. Let's just leave it there.
So, what's the time frame in this movie?
The time frame is, at the moment, they haven't announced much. They're in the script stage.
Okay.
You know, we'll see.
George Miller still attached or no longer?
Not that we know of, no. Okay. He's obviously hoping to be busy pretty soon with Max Fury Road. So.
I'd love to have known. I'd love to have seen his Justice League movie, because I think they'd got as far as building sets. So they were starting to build sets down in Australia. Yeah. They'd cast everybody from Armie Hammer as Batman to Common as Green Lantern to I think Megan Gale as Wonder Woman, and DJ Catrona, who sounds like a brand of beer but is actually an actor. He was Superman. And it was going to be really weird, because it was going to exist alongside the Nolan Batman. So we could have had... And in fact, the Zack Snyder Superman. So, well, we would have had two different Batmans and two different Supermans. It would,
as far as I know, I mean, with this one, you know, from, we haven't heard anything so far to indicate that we're not talking about a different franchise to the Zack Snyder Man of Steel. So we could we could still have two Supermans running alongside each other. It remains to be seen very much.
I don't think that's a great idea, but I can also sense Amedee Bodega screaming at his computer, "Stop talking about the Avengers!" So we're going to move on now. James, what have you been mulling over this week?
A doubleheader of TV news, actually, kind of grabbed my fancy. First of all, the Scream TV series has been commissioned by MTV, which I thought was an odd choice.
Why is that?
Well, it seems like an odd thing to make up of a series, doesn't it? I mean, what structure would let's assume a 22-episode season of Scream take?
Well, the thing about the Scream movies is that, unlike your Friday the 13th or your Halloweens, they are murder mysteries.
Mm.
It's just trying to work out who is Ghostface. So I can see that working over a series, so much like Twin Peaks.
So sort of like The Killing, but sort of stretching
a little bit, or, you know, Who Killed Laura Palmer, but the cast gradually gets whittled away week on week. So is this connected in any way to the chronology or to the time frame of
there's not even a script, so it's kind of hard to say. The thing is, it feels a little bit like it's treading the ground that Harper's Island did in 2009. Did anyone see Harper's Island?
Didn't that last about 8 episodes?
13 episodes, yeah. It got cancelled pretty sharpish. The problem with shows like that are heavily... sort of like story-based, arc-based, is that if you miss one or two, then they tend to lose viewers, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely.
And certainly for network television, they don't tend to do very well.
So. Isn't there also a sense that Scream 4 underperformed? So yeah. Therefore, does the brand still have that resonance?
Well, I think, who knows what's actually prompted this? I mean, they're doing quite well with their Teen Wolf. Has anyone seen that? MTV are running their Teen Wolf TV show, which isn't dreadful, amazingly.
Or as Russell Brand called it at the MTV Movie Awards, Teen Mom. Indicating that he's perhaps not au fait with the output of the channel.
Yes.
His awards he was hosting.
Indeed. But anyway, so there's Scream, the TV show, and then obviously there's news that Mads Mikkelsen has been cast as Hannibal Lecter.
Now, this is interesting. I'm not saying the first one wasn't.
Suddenly I've interested
but
you.
But now I'm interested in this one, because this is Brian Fuller, who's also rebooting
Pushing
the Munsters.
Brian
Absolutely. As Mockingbird Lane. So he's cast Jerry O'Connell this week as Herman Munster. And Eddie Izzard is Grandpa Munster.
Yes.
And it's a kind of a more dramatic, dark, Tim Burton-esque take on the Munsters. But yeah, this is very interesting because he's also doing Hannibal, or essentially the story that takes place before Red Dragon. So
that's
it's
right.
Will Graham versus Hannibal Lecter, but over two or three seasons or something like that.
Yeah.
And Hugh Dancy?
Yeah, that's right.
Hugh Dancy is Will Graham.
And
right.
they were both in King Arthur, so, you know.
They were both in King Arthur. And Mads Mikkelsen's now been cast as Hannibal Lecter. So where do we stand
It's an interesting thing, because the setup for this, because it's pre-Red Dragon, is that Hannibal Lecter is in no way the villain. So it's all foreshadowing. He's the helpful Dr. Lecter who helps, comedy, I'll help you solve your crimes.
But he's killing people
and
all
eating
the time.
Them, yes. Yeah. But I think that's very much implied rather than shown. I think you'll probably get hints of him being quite sinister, but other than that, him, you know, just snacking on the odd limb.
Okay. So where do we stand on Mads? Is this good casting?
I think this could be good, actually. I'm open to this one, because I quite like Mads Mikkelsen, for a start. But also, I mean, you know, it might help erase the scars that were caused by Hannibal, because it was awful.
It is a very thankless role, though, isn't it? Because it's a role that Hopkins is so iconic for that it's almost, how do you inhabit that role and turn it into something else?
But I think he's a kind of a different enough guy that he could do it well in a strange way. You don't want somebody who's doing a Hopkins impression. You want someone who can bring something else to the role but still kind of fit the role. And I think Mads Mikkelsen has enough kind of menace to him to be able to do that, but also has, you know, a bit of intelligence as an actor and a bit of kind of wit about him. So I think he could be good.
Because it's going to be a subtle performance, because he does have to walk that line where he is essentially a co-hero. He's not the villain of this particular piece. So.
Yeah, but he's also killing people in the background while Will Graham
is he? We don't know. We assume so.
You know, he's got to be.
But then, obviously, this is the other... There's two of these currently in development, aren't there? Two Hannibal-esque offshoot TV shows. There's Clarice as well, which is being put together as well, which takes place in between Silence and Hannibal, which is quite an interesting one. But obviously focusing on Clarice Starling when she's starting out as an FBI agent. So she's met Hannibal at that point, but he's not really in the picture.
Are there any characters from those books that aren't being having a TV show? Is Barney the Orderly going to get it?
Dr. Chilton will be starring in a sort of scrub spin-off psychiatric comedy. It's going to be quite
sounds exciting. Amazing. Yeah. Dr. Cox, sweetbreads being served up. That should be amazing. And Ian, something called the Golden Trailers has been keeping you awake at night, hasn't it?
Yeah, the Golden Trailer Awards were held last week in LA, and they're kind of awards that are kind of for the best in show in trailers.
Okay.
So it's a very short ceremony, 2.5 minutes long, not yet rated. And so basically, the big winner of the night was The Dark Knight Rises for its second trailer, which is the one where they start singing Star Spangled Banner and ends up with the big Batman theme, and then in between, you know, Bane walks in with Del Boy's coat on and all that kind of thing. And so that was the big winner. Also won the best thriller was The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, which
was
an amazing trailer. The best comedy was Bridesmaid. The Muppets picked up for something. But the kind of thing that didn't...
Which trailer?
I think...
The Muppets
number 350.
For the campaign, I think that they picked up something for that. But Prometheus didn't get anything. And that, to me, is about, you know, whatever you think of the film...
It's a great trailer.
It's a terrific trailer.
Oh, phenomenal. Yeah, the marketing campaign on Prometheus was great. I definitely would have given this something ahead of The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, but it just got me thinking that, you know, I think the internet's been a brilliant thing for if you're a movie fan. It absolutely enriched a movie fan's life. But the one thing I think it's kind of done us a service to is going to the cinema to see trailers. That used to be the most exciting thing when you're a movie fan. Now I just get to see them on, you know, a very small screen, and there's trailers for the trailers, and there's not that map.
Yeah,
I went to see, I remember going as a kid to see a reissue of Star Wars that had an Empire Strikes Back trailer on, which was basically just stills of the film played with some Vivaldi music. And that was the most exciting thing in the world. And maybe people feel like that when they're watching these things on their little computer screens.
Well, I think the art of trailer making has transformed. If you look at trailers from the 1960s, whatever, for James Bond, they're just dreadful. They're extraordinarily cheesy, but it has changed so much over the years. I mean, Aaron Creevy, who's the director of Welcome to the Punch, tweeted the other day a teaser trailer for Alien 3 that came out in played in cinemas in 1991, and this is a point where they didn't even have a script for the movie, and they were just kind of guessing. But it's a trailer where this, you know, this close up of an alien egg, and it's pulling out, and this voiceover in tones, really serious, you know, like the war. It's essentially the war will come to Earth in 1992. I was like, well, that didn't happen. But I'd love to go into the cinema and have seen that. You know,
and
have that
there was that Terminator 2 teaser, wasn't there?
Oh, that amazing T2. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Absolutely, it has changed.
The first trailer, the Phantom Menace trailer, was the first one that I can remember just watching again and again and again and becoming obsessed with.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, but you say that you can't talk about going to cinemas. I mean, I don't know whether James is in the same boat here, but when the Phantom Menace trailer came out in 1999 and I dial up internet.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it took me 2.5 hours to download this 2.5 minute trailer, but I would just sit and watch it over and over and over again. And I think that actually feeds into why I do a lot of the trailer breakdowns for Empire, because I love going frame by frame on trailers for big movies and trying to figure out who is that, what is that, what is that, what's the significance of that shot. But also trailer making has changed so much these days as well, because if I were director, you'd be furious with some of the Prometheus trailers.
The Prometheus trailer actually includes like the last shot of the film.
It
has in the clouds.
Well, the last shot of the film is
spoilers.
The coda,
That's in one of the trailers.
But they don't seem to be preparing people. If you look at the Dark Shadows trailer, that is not that movie. It's a really funny trailer.
Yeah.
But it makes the film look like it's a knockabout comedy, and it's not. And it's not. It's setting up an expectation for a film that won't deliver. Then you feel disappointed, and it just doesn't seem...
That's cynical marketing people for you, isn't it?
Of course it is, yeah. I saw a TV spot last night for Casa de Mi Padre, which is a film entirely in Spanish, and there is no dialogue in the trailer. It just goes, Will Ferrell's back, and he's done it again! He's so funny! And you can just imagine people going to see this movie thinking, oh, it's going to be Will Ferrell, knockabout comedy. And then 10 minutes in going, why is it not in English? And then like half an hour in going, this isn't Spanish, isn't it? Or, you know, whatever language they think it is. And then I'd love, you know, the cinema manager goes, oh, God, here's another refund. But, yeah, so, I don't know. But brilliant. Thanks, Ian. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the week's new releases, including Simon Pegg in A Fantastic Fear of Everything, which is a directorial debut of Crispian Mills, who is that bloke from Cooler Shaker, but, and this is perhaps more pertinent, he's also that bloke whose mum is Hayley Mills and whose granddad is Sir John Mills, so film definitely runs in his blood. The film is based on Bruce Robinson's novella Paranoia at the Laundrette, and it stars Pegg as the world's most paranoid man, and he and Mills came in last week to talk to Helen and Nick Desemlin. Enjoy.
Very pleased to have you here.
Nice
you've
be here.
Been a long time web chat guest, but this is your first podcast with us.
I haven't experienced the podcast yet, and it's a pleasure to be here.
It's basically like the web chat. It's a bit anarchic and doesn't make much sense, so you should be right at home.
It's the way we like it at Empire.
So tell me about the film. I mean, I've really enjoyed it. I think it's fair to say it's a bit offbeat. It involves, you know, probably more kind of hedgehogs and laundromats than your average kind of thriller. I think it's probably fair to say
it is replete with those things, but and oddly they're the most scary aspects of it. But it's why don't you feel this one? It's at least since you were there at the inception.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it was interesting when we, you know, you start taking your script around to meet, you know, with people, prospective film financiers. And it all does all come down to the pitch, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, there's some dysfunctional hedgehogs. And
it's about a man in his underpants.
You know, and it's, I mean, that is that's the part, the selling point of the film is that it is, you can't really put it into a normal kind of film pitch, and that's great and exciting, but it does make it a little bit difficult in those meetings.
Yeah, I can only imagine how you managed to get it done. And you've got you know, animation elements in there as well. You've got Victorian serial killers mixing with children's books.
Mm.
I mean, it initially
was based on a novella by Bruce Robinson called Paranoia in the Laundrette. And Crispian bought me his adaptation of that a long time ago, like 3 or 4 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, incredible amount of time ago.
And we spoke about it in terms of it perhaps being something bigger than that. we decided to expand the idea into something more, and Crispian came up with
some crazy ideas.
Yeah,
I mean, the truth is, I at the beginning I was sort of tiptoeing very reverentially around Bruce Robinson's hallowed words, and if it hadn't been for him saying, "Chuck your script in the bin, chuck my book in the bin," you know, that's what you have to do. It was a liberating moment. Mm. It could have ended in tears, but luckily, you know, we got this crazy story about the subplot about his past as a children's author.
There were tears in the middle, but it wasn't at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
Has he seen it? Has he liked it?
Well, he would see it if he would leave hay.
Right.
Hay and why? He's making love in hay. You know, and I can't blame him. I mean, part of what makes him great is he's a grumpy old recluse.
He liked the trailer, didn't he?
Absolutely adored it. Yeah. So.
Which was enough for me. I was kind of, you know, obviously I'm a huge fan of his and of With Nell and I, and to be part of a film which is in some way, you know, connected with him was a big deal. But he said that I made a good looking Jack, so that's, I'll take that to the bank.
You've got 6 degrees of separation now from With Nell.
Yes,
that's
yes,
good.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Jack's kind of like the weird bastard son of With Nell and I, in that he's a sort of self professed romantic kind of posh tramp character who has a huge opinion of himself but keeps, you know, succumbing to dreadful mishaps. And it was fun to play him in that tradition, you know, particularly when I was wearing the dressing gown and the pants and having long hair. It was great.
The hair was memorable, I have to say, almost as memorable as the pants. I mean, it's just just the whole aura of desperation and just the build-up of everything that could possibly go wrong.
Oh, I know.
Things that could never go wrong to any reasonable person going wrong to this man were just amazing.
I know, he loses a sock to carol singers. I mean, what is that all about?
I have a question, I guess it's for both of you. Are there essential kind of freak-out performances that you looked at before you started this? I know you mentioned on Twitter Shelley Duvall from The Shining.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Shelley Duvall was... Well, they were kind of like notes, weren't they? In discussion... I don't think there was a hell of a lot of research.
There's that amazing YouTube clip of Nick Cage losing his shit. Have you seen that? I just watched that. No, Shelley Duvall was actually, funnily enough, in the sequence when Jack comes face to face with the lead head, the long ear, one of the serial killers he's researching. I totally channeled Shelley Duvall, that sort of silent screaming. I never forget as a kid being totally freaked out by the cover of The Shining video and the sheer terror on her face.
Yeah, well, something strange happened in the early 80s. If you went into a video store, it was only horror and porn.
That's because all they could clear was there was no statutory legislation for video release, and all the studios thought it was a fad, so they wouldn't put new releases on.
Well, I went in there looking for Herbie Goes to Monte Carlo or something, and I was like looking at these covers, which gave me nightmares.
Death Trap and
My Bloody Valentine, you know, the guy with the kebab stuck in his mouth, and all this, and very lo-fi artwork.
Well, a lot of stuff came in from Europe because, you know, they could get past the censors and stuff, and so that's why that's the whole Video Nasty thing happened because of that. It was a weird time.
That's probably why we have the geek culture that we do now, because everybody grew up in their formative years. They went into video shops and all they could find was, you know, all of the horror.
Yeah, and Sylvester Stallone in soft porn.
Yeah.
You've been writing for quite a while. I read, again, this is probably not true, but I read that you wrote your first script when you were 10.
Oh, yeah.
No, that's true.
It was a genius move, actually, yeah. Yeah, and it was awful, awful movie. I think it's a slightly Dungeons and Dragons type script.
We should do it.
Well, the cartoon series would have been on at that point, right? So.
Oh, I didn't see it.
Oh,
no,
okay, so you can't even blame that.
No, I can't even. No,
Game of Thrones is, you know, kicking off now, so.
Exactly.
It was Game of Thrones, wasn't it, that you wrote?
That's right, call my lawyer. You just got to write and write and write, and that's how you learn how to do it. And, but I started writing scripts again about 12 years ago while I was making a record. So Ringo learned to play chess and I started writing, you know, that's yeah. What you do is so much hanging around. But, you know, that is how you learn. And I saw Bruce a while back and he said, you know, I've got 50 scripts there on that shelf, and only three of them have ever been made. So it's heartening in a way, but also incredibly depressing.
Yeah, yeah, it's both.
Wow, that's not a good ratio.
You just have to keep going, you know.
Yeah, and how about you? Did you, you know, you write? Did you bond over writing? Did you?
I just. It's really nice when you get a script that you just think this is fine. I don't, you know, as a writer, you often kind of want to intercede and think, oh, that. It was really nice to read it and just really just enjoy it and love the turn of phrase. I love Crispian's kind of, he had a very Bruce Robinson-y turn of phrase. His contribution was indistinguishable from Bruce's because it had that feel, you know, and it was just a joy to read it, and it made me laugh. You know, I love some of the phrasing.
We developed script on the floor, didn't we?
Yeah,
ideas on the floor.
On the killing floor.
Yeah, you know, and that was really good fun. I mean, there was stuff that came out of the shoot that the
little nuances that, yeah.
Was the gangster rap in the script?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it was
Uzi-licious.
You couldn't imagine it was going to be as embarrassing as it turned out. No, I mean that whole thing with his mixtape that you brought in was brilliant. So
yeah, Catherine.
Yeah,
going out to
the mixtape.
The only way to do that whole gangster rap moment was to do it utterly faithfully. You know, it's like I wasn't going to try and send it up by doing some sort of bad Ali G impression. I thought, I'm just going to do this as best as I possibly can, and it will be funny. Trust that it will be funny, because I am a white man in a towel, you know, and way out of my wheelhouse. And it just was naturally ridiculous. And I had so much fun doing it. It was one of those things where the whole cast and crew were just gobsmacked and just terribly embarrassed.
On your behalf.
On my behalf, yeah. And it was Crispin's idea that I would have Jack's flintlock pistol as my gat. It's such a kind of ridiculous thing that he's kind of brandishing this flintlock pistol.
Yeah.
Like it's an AK.
And Simon, you have a spectacularly bedraggled look in this, the hair and all over the place. Did you maintain that throughout the shoot, or did you get home and...
I did. No, I was sort of instructed by hair and makeup to let my nails grow and not shave for a long time. And even though that's a very spectacular wig, which was, you know, applied to my head by Laura Blant every morning, it was frightened the life out of my daughter. Like any time my daughter came to set, it'd have to be explained to her that Daddy was in his funny costume.
It frightened my kid, who's three as well.
Yeah, but he's got the same haircut.
Yeah, he got the same haircut, so I don't know what's going on. No, I didn't understand why he thought it was so frightening. Oh, you were covered in blood.
He came to the set that day when I was covered in blood,
yeah. I'd gotten used to it.
He was a little freaked out by that, with the big bandage on my head. Mm. But it was really fun to be that, you know, to be that immersed in a look. And also similarly with the pants and the cashmere sweater, I after the first day of people being slightly disturbed by it, I was just able to just wander around in my pants the whole time and nobody batted an eyelid. I mean, what kind of dream is that you could turn up to work in just your underwear and nobody cares? It's wonderful.
That is the dream.
Yeah,
I think,
it's like,
right?
You know, and I have this special chair that whenever I do a job at home, I have this deck chair which I take with me to set, because it's a nice thing to sit on between takes, because I like to stay on set. And I just used to sit on it, and it's a recliner. So I would fall asleep as well. So I'd be lying there asleep with my legs sprawled open in just my pants. So everyone just walking around me, not taking a blind bit of notice. It was joyous.
So I'm curious about the nails. So you had a bit of a Howard Hughes kind of thing going on.
Yeah, it was just weird, but I'd bite them as well, or I'd be desperate to bite them. And I'd have one that would continue to grow and the others would be bitten, and there'd be just this long one single fingernail, which is very strange.
Use that to turn the pages of whatever book.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It was fun to be a bit method. I'm not a method actor by any degree, but it was nice to actually, you know, get a bit lost in the role.
All the beakers of urine as well.
That was a bit upsetting,
that was
a
bit... far.
That did get noticed.
Yeah.
So, Simon, am I right in thinking The World's End is your next performance?
Yes.
And how are you kind of getting into the headspace for that? Or
well, I'm just gearing up for it, really, and I'm very excited to play the part and of Gary King, as we all now know he's called. Not all of us, obviously. Some of the people that are listening to this, that's the first time you've heard it. But Gary will take his place alongside Nicholas Angel and Sean as another Edgar and Redgar Wright and me creation. And But over the summer, I think I'm just going to stay at home, and I think I might write a book. I just want to be at home. I've been away for 6 months, and I want to come home and just sit in my house now.
In the pants.
In my pants. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It all comes full circle.
Yeah.
And how did Star Trek go?
It was really good. It was an awesome, fun job. I mean, you know, it was 5 months of playing in the most hilariously cool environment, and you know, hanging out with very cool people. And I love working for J.J. Abrams because he's such an inspiration, and he's such an enthusiast that it trickles down from him as the head of the body politic into everybody, and so it was a hoot. And I think he showed me like a sizzle reel of the movie about right 2.5 months into shooting, and it was cut together with footage that we'd shot and previs, which is a fantastic new tool. And it was so amazing and exciting. Just, and you know, half of it was animated, but it just looked incredible. And I just thought, you could put this on the net now, and people would piss their pants with excitement. So yeah, I'm pretty confident it's going to be amazing.
Okay, now I know you can't tell us anything plot wise. Can you tell us, will there be lens flare?
Of course, there's lens flare. We call it best in show, and it's what we do is you it's a little technique that you use. And for JJ, it's a way of sort of getting across a kind of odd documentary realism. It's like it's breaking the fourth wall. Basically, you're basically drawing attention to the fact that it's a movie, but in doing so, you're creating a subliminal reality. Now everyone's going, oh yeah, lens flare. They don't realize how sort of, you know,
it's not just a lens flare. Fucking with your mind.
It's encouraging the audience to believe that it's a documentary.
Yeah. Well, the first one totally worked. It's one of two films ever to have made me cry before the opening credits. So
yeah, me too. I watched it when my wife was pregnant the first time, and I was a mess before it even started. We have Thor. Thor was in it. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now look at him. He's done well.
He's done all right.
And Crispin, what have you got coming up?
That was him, was it?
Chris.
Yeah. Chris Hemsworth.
Of course. That's right.
Yeah. Killed him off. What have you got coming up?
I've got 50 scripts on the shelf. hopefully one of them I can find some interest for it.
Is there a hedgehog in any of these 50 scripts?
I'd like to go to India. I'd like to make a film in India. Anyone know anyone in India with a film studio?
No. Judy Dench was there. I don't know. Right.
What about that whole Bollywood? That's pretty thriving. You could go.
They must make films there.
Yeah.
I spoke to Chris O'Dowd while I was out in Cannes, and he said he and Nick Frost are preparing for Cuban Fury.
Yes.
Down the road from here.
Yes.
In the Pineapple Studios. So
that's
right. Are you going to pop in and see what they're up to?
I definitely will. Yeah. Now I'm back from space, I really want to catch up. And I saw Nick the other night. He came to see Fantastic Fear, and I really want to go and check out what's going on. And he's got a fantastic... Has the cast been announced? Who do you know is in it?
I can't remember, but I know I know those two are in it.
Chris.
But I think a bunch more people have been announced.
Yeah, yeah. And he's got some cool people in it, and I'm excited for him. You know, I always like to see things with him in it, because usually I'm in it as well, which is distracting for me. I prefer to see things with him in it on his own. So I'm looking forward to Cuban Fury.
But I take it you and Nick have been on a few dance floors together in your time.
Oh, man, like you wouldn't believe. We've been on every kind of dance floor. The from rave to sort of, you know, a rodeo, we've been on. We've been everywhere.
Joe Cornish has described his dancing style as like a squid spinning on a stick. How would you describe
Joe
when we did Pint of Milk with him?
That was
his memorable kind of description of it. How would you describe your Nick kind of?
Well, Nick and I are both pretty good dancers, to be honest. I mean, we've done comedy dancing, both of us, but I'm sure Nick's going to impress in Cuban Fury. You know, his skills are going to will scintillate. And, you know, I can cut a rug when I need to, in a non-comic way.
Okay.
Maybe in the sequel, Cuban and Fury 2.
Yeah.
Furiouser.
The Cuban and the Fury. Oh, no, forget it.
Two Cuban, two Furious.
Yeah, that's the one. That's what I was looking for.
Print.
All right. Well, Chris Mills and Simon Pegg, thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for letting me use your charger for my phone.
Peggy Mills there, top chaps they are as well. Very, very sad to have missed that one. But that's not the only interview we have for you lucky, lucky people. Just as the star of How to Lose Friends and Alienate People has a movie coming out on Friday, so does his director. Robert Wiley is something of a comedy legend around these parts. He's best known as the director of some of the best Curb Your Enthusiasm episodes, and he's recently focused on another comedy legend. Woody Allen, a documentary, saw Wiley granted exclusive access to the guy who directed Annie Hall, Manhattan, Bananas, Midnight in Paris, Hannah and Her Sisters. Ian, you could probably throw in some clunkers here to kind of to balance all the good ones.
Curse of the Jade Scorpion, Mighty Aphrodite,
Cassandra's Dream.
Cassandra's Dream. What was one with Jason Biggs?
Anything else?
Yeah, anything else? No, we'll stop there. Whitey dropped in this week to have a natter about the documentary, and he was talking to Nick, Ian Freer, and myself. Robert Whitey, how are you, sir?
I'm swell. How are you?
I'm good. I'm not too bad. I've got a cold, so I probably shouldn't have shaken your hand. I'm so sorry about that.
Wait, let me get out my Purell. I'm never without it. By the way, if you ever want to befriend Woody Allen, that's the best way to do it. When you see him, you know, somebody forces him into a handshake, and they walk away, and he's standing there. Just you whip out the Purell, and you give it to him, and then you're his best friend.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
That's a tip.
For future reference, definitely. I met Ridley Scott last week. He has a flu. He doesn't do it. He just puts his hands up immediately and goes, no, cold, get away. Yeah. Which is, he's a knight. He can do these sort of things.
I'm all for the bow. I like what the Japanese, I'm going to start bowing. I think we did a Curb episode on that. We talked about the bow. I'd love to bring the bow to the United States.
It's such a polite thing, the bow. It's great. Yeah. It is. So Woody Allen documentary is fantastic. He's a hell of a subject. So what made you decide to do a doc on Woody in the first place?
Well, you know, all of my documentaries have been on my own sort of cultural and artistic heroes and influences. And Woody was among them. I mean, my first film was on the Marx Brothers, who were my first loves. And most of these influences I talk about are comedic, you know, W.C. Fields and Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul, who's a very important American stand-up comedian. So, and Woody was among them. I saw Take the Money and Run when I was 9 years old and loved it straight away. So I went to see all of his movies. And then Annie Hall was one of those changed my life films. But I mean, I was never sycophantic, but I admired him. I just thought he was a really interesting filmmaker. And so I, you know, he had always been hesitant to do anything like this. And it was never, because I had approached him, I met him in 1982. In fact, he was in my Marx Brothers film. And I was so young at the time. The nice thing is I started to ask him about doing this documentary, and he always politely said no. And I thought, you know, I'll just go back every decade and eventually wear him down. And finally it happened. But his hesitation was never about content or creative control. It was always the self-deprecating thing about, who am I to have a documentary like this? I'm not a great filmmaker. I'm not, you know, Bergman or Kurosawa or Renoir or De Sica. You know, and who's ever going to finance this, and who's ever going to watch it? And that was sort of the hump I had to get him over, which was basically, don't you worry your pretty little head over that. You know, believe me, there's an audience for this. So I wrote him a letter in October of 2008. And I sort of made this double case. The first case I made was that it's time to do this. Mm-hmm. And the second argument was that I'm the one to do it. And he caved.
Fantastic. Was there ever any worries about him being... He strikes me as being a very private person. You get incredible access to him in the film. He seems to be very open about his childhood, about his relationships. Was there any worry for him at any point about opening up so much?
No. I think in the same way that on a featured film, I mean a narrative film, the way an actor has to, if they're going to do a project, they have to trust the director and, you know, metaphorically be willing to fall back into their arms. I think when you're dealing with a live documentary subject, and not all of mine have been live, I think it's, you know, the same sort of trust has to go into it. So, you know, the big hurdle was getting him to agree to do this in the first place. And once he did, he was very open with me. There were no restrictions. He never suggested what I could or could not talk about. You know, he, in fact, during the course of production, there were a few times where I said, hey, I just cut together this very cool sequence on Annie Hall. Can I send it to you? He'd say, no, I'm barely going to be able to look at this stuff once, let alone again and again. So just wait until you have the finished film. So he was very trusting, and there was no question that I felt I couldn't ask him. Again, the difficulties were getting him to agree there was value in doing some things. For instance, I thought it would be very cool to be on the set with him because nobody's seen him at work on a set unless you've been on a Woody Allen set because he doesn't have EPK crews. There's never publicity crews around. So I thought, you know, and he was shooting here in London. He was shooting You'll Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger. This was summer of 2009, I guess. I said, can I come? And he said, you know, my sets are boring. Nothing exciting ever happens. I barely talk to the actors. You'll be flying out from LA to London. It's very expensive. I don't think you're going to wind up with anything usable. He said, if you want to come, you can come. But I, you know, think about it.
Okay.
And I said, no, I want to do it. He said, okay, he was fine. Same thing about taking him back to his childhood neighborhood in Brooklyn. I thought that'd be a very cool thing to do. And again, it was, he says, look, nobody cares where I grew up or where I went to school or where I played stickball in the streets. You know, I can't imagine just walking around town and saying, oh, here's where I grew up, like anybody cares. You know, if you want to do it, we'll do it. So those were the sorts of things that took some effort to talk him into. But in an interview situation, I felt there was no question that was off limits.
Okay. And how long did you spend with Woody, first of all?
That question is off limits.
Okay.
from the time I approached him until the time the film was finished was 3 years. I would say between two and a half years of solid production. And, you know, I interviewed him. I was, you know, on and off during that time. I don't know exactly how much time we spent, but I logged an awful lot of FaceTime with him. I mean, I think there were maybe half a dozen formal sit-down lit interviews. Uh-huh. There was the Verite material in Brooklyn and in London. I filmed him in his home. You actually see him, as you know, seeing the film, you actually see him writing a first draft of a script, which he writes in longhand on a yellow legal pad on his bed.
On his bed, yeah.
Yeah, and then he types it up, the first draft, on this old Olympia portable manual typewriter that he bought me when he was 16. It's the only thing he's ever written anything on. So you see him in his home. And so, you know, we spent quite a bit of time. I filmed him in his editing room. So, the nice thing is that because he is very shy, as you pointed out, Scarlett Johansson refers to him as being cripplingly shy. Mm. And this has nothing to do with his celebrity status or anything. This goes back to childhood. You know, he's always been that way.
But also a lot of time, Bob, as well, going through archive footage, which I imagine must have thrown up the odd surprise. I mean, there's these great footage from the Dick Cavett Show and What's My Line, or that's what we know it as over here. I mean, was there anything that really surprised you or anything that you thought that can't exist anymore?
I'll tell you, the business which people talk about when they see the film, because it's so bizarre, is him boxing an actual live kangaroo.
Yes.
In fact, that was on a British show. That was called Hippodrome.
Yeah.
He actually did a fair amount of British TV. You see the Derek Nemo thing and, the David Frost was out of New York, but the boxing the kangaroo, that was odd, and all that early TV stuff, you know, that all, it's funny because Woody is now known as this guy with, you know, so much integrity, he won't do this, he won't do that, he doesn't show up for the Oscars, but it's so funny to see that there was a time in his career where he'd do anything, and that came from, I mean, this was the time, I mean, he had great managers, Jack Rollins and Charles Joffe were legendary, and now the point of management, the way I see it, at least where I come from, is to just cave in and give the clients whatever they need so they don't leave you.
Yeah.
But back at that time, clients listened to the managers instead of the other way around, and they did what they were told. And Jack Rollins told Woody, you do as much TV as possible because you got to enter people's living rooms. America has to know who you are. The world has to know who you are. You need to become a household word so that your career can grow off of that. So Woody did all these game shows. You see him singing with a talking dog and I've Got a Secret or something. All this dopey stuff. He did, you know, advertisements. He did ads for Foster Grant's sunglasses and men's shirts and Aero shirts and Smirnoff vodka. So he was quite available for those gigs back then.
Right. And what does Woody think of those things now? Because he does project this image of, as you said, he's very self-deprecating. He doesn't see himself in the same bracket as Bergman or Kurosawa. He seems to be very much, in some ways, a tortured artist. Does he look back on those things with, I guess, embarrassment? Does he?
He looks back at those with embarrassment, but the odd thing about him is, you know, he looks at Manhattan with embarrassment.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, he's a tough customer, especially when it comes to his own work. Now, I'm being somewhat facetious by comparing the two, but there is a connection. I mean, you see in the documentary that when Manhattan came out, he thought he had botched it so badly that he offered United Artists, the releasing studio, that he would do a film for them for free if they would not release it. He thought Manhattan was unreleasable. You know, you ask him about Annie. I mean, the number of people I know who say that, you know, the film Annie Hall changed their lives. I mean, Woody just shrugs and says, well, that's a very sad statement about their lives. You know, he thinks it's okay. He doesn't hate it. But yeah, the really early stuff really bothers him. And it was the one thing that I was concerned about. I wasn't concerned about any of the Mia Farrow stuff and Sun Yee and all that. The thing I was concerned about was I know he has such a dislike for his early stand-up material, which, by the way, for any comedy buffs who follow American stand-up comedy, I don't know anybody who doesn't think that his stand-up was brilliant. And most of it still exists on record, I guess. Most of it is available digitally now. I have the LPs and the CDs, yeah. You know, years and years ago. But sure enough, you know, when he finally watched the film, that was the one area that he was... You know, he said, oh boy, that joke that I did on the Jack Parr show. I always hated that. I never knew why people laughed. It wasn't funny then. It's not funny now. Can you find anything to swap out for that joke? So a couple of those, literally like two, he was so adamant about that I really did swap them out.
Oh, really?
Because, I mean, what did I care? I used this joke or that joke.
That's still a good joke.
All great. Gold, isn't it?
Yeah. So it was an easy bone to throw him. I didn't care. But seeing that early stuff really embarrasses him.
So he's still rewriting himself 50 years after the fact, which is amazing. But did you get any insights into his, I guess, working process? I mean, you said there's that great footage of him writing on the bed, which always made me think when I see that stuff, he's going to have back problems, surely, because he's leaning over and he's hunched and he's writing longhand. That can't be good for your hand.
Well, yeah, so our parents told us that, and they told us not to sit too close to the television or we'd go blind. There's other stuff in high school that was going to make us go blind. I don't know if any of that really came about. I mean, he's 76 now, and he's holding up pretty well. By the way, I should point out, because there's been some confusion about this, there are two versions of the film. What was done originally for American Public Television was a two-parter. It was 3.5 hours.
This is PBS.
Right. Yeah. But then once there was an opportunity to actually put the film in cinemas here in England and elsewhere, I just thought, well, you know, it's just unfair to ask. And, you know, you can't put a 3.5-hour movie into a cinema. So I did the cut down myself. I cut it down to just under 2 hours, which is much more watchable in one sitting. But my basic tact is to tell people, and I don't say this to shill the film, it's true, is that if you like Woody Allen, by all means go to the cinema and see it. And if you're a real Woody Allen nut, the longer version will likely, certainly it will be on DVD eventually. His process, you know, writing, casting is covered more in the longer version than the shorter version. Seeing him on the set directing, seeing him in the editing room, I mean, I follow Tall Dark Stranger through that process, and then you see him finally releasing the film at the Cannes Film Festival, and then I went back the next year for Midnight in Paris. But this stuff was interesting to me because, as I say, you never see it, but to actually see the process by which he writes. And we were talking about the typewriter before. When I didn't know he was going to show me the typewriter, and when he did, I found it pretty fascinating. And I said to him, knowing that he is not a man who utilizes modern technology, I said, well, how do you cut and paste on a computer or word processor? You can digitally cut and paste. What do you do? And he said, well, I keep these little scissors here. And he has these scissors, by his desk. And he literally cuts out, like if he's doing a rewrite and there's a section that he likes, he physically cuts that from the piece of paper and he actually staples it onto the new piece and puts it into his typewriter. So he's very old school that way.
Did you try and persuade him to upgrade to a word processor or, heaven forfend, a computer?
Yeah, I'm going to tell Woody Allen how to live his life. he's been so unsuccessful at the way he's been doing it that I should come along and tell him how to do it. No, he even laughs in the film because he's showing me this stuff. And as he's saying it for the camera, he realizes how ridiculous it sounds. And at one point, he kind of chuckles and he says, I know this sounds very primitive, but it's always worked for me. And he's not a big fan of change, you know. He does have an iPhone, by the way. He uses it for actual phone calls. He carries a lot of music on it because, he loves jazz, old jazz and New Orleans jazz and Sidney Bechet and that sort of thing and music from the 40s. So it's loaded up with some music, so he has that with him. And then the only thing he does that's sort of internet-related is he'll check the weather. And Owen Wilson said that when they're doing Midnight in Paris, he knew he could always chat with Woody by coming up to him and saying, so Woody, what's the weather in Cairo today? And Woody would say, oh, let me see. And he would be very excited about being able to tell him what the weather was in Cairo. So that's Woody's iPhone, and that's about as far as technology goes.
I'd love to see a Woody Allen weather app. That'd be absolutely amazing.
It's rainy today and should be sunny later, but probably the clouds will come back and it'll be miserable.
That's an amazing impression.
Have you done your impression for him? Has he seen your impression?
No, I would never do that.
Okay, competition time now. Last week we offered you the chance to win one of three custom designed Prometheus posters by Ibrahim Youssef. To win, you had to answer the following ridiculously easy question. Prometheus is the name of the ship in Prometheus, but what's the name of the ship in Alien? Oh, anyone? Anyone? Anyone?
Nostromo.
Nostromo, absolutely. And the three winners are Brian Cummings, who lives all the way in Delaware, which is, I believe, is in the United States, Danny Hasty, and Martin McWilliams. This week's competition ties nicely into Bob Whitey's presence. We have three Curb Your Enthusiasm DVD box sets. That's every single season of Larry David's Misadventures from seasons 1 through to 8 to give away. That's a cracking prize. I want one myself, actually. Free box sets, brilliant. The box set is out on June 11th, but to save three of you your hard-earned cash, all you have to do is answer this week's following ridiculously easy question, and my God, this one is ridiculously easy. Larry David, the star of Curb Your Enthusiasm, co-created which classic sitcom?
Apart from Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Apart
right.
from Curb Your Enthusiasm, okay. Obviously. Yeah, to the first one. The first classic sitcom that Larry David co-created. And that's it. If you don't know it, and you frankly have our sympathies, and you should probably be listening to another podcast, send in your answer along with your name and address to podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, now it's time to tackle the week's cinematic releases. Interestingly, following last week's double whammy of Prometheus and Snow White and the Huntsman, which were both massive blockbusters, this week's given over to smaller independent releases. So let's start with the aforementioned A Fantastic Fear of Everything, which is a very quirky, bizarre, original black comedy. And given that it's based on Bruce Robinson's novella, there are going to be immediate comparisons to With Nell and I, but it's not quite With Nell and I, is it, Helen?
No, it's definitely not. There are comparisons. I think the, you know, like With Nell, it involves a very eccentric English person. He lives in a really gross environment.
This is Peg.
Yeah. And he really needs to sort his life out. So yeah, there are comparisons.
And get the washing done.
Yeah. This is basically his struggle is that he's a children's book author who's trying to turn kind of into more adult-oriented fiction, and has been researching Victorian serial killers, and has basically gone a bit over the edge as a result. He's incredibly paranoid. He's worried that, you know, people are out to get him, and that axe murderers are after him. And yes, even worse, he has to go to an important meeting.
No.
He has nothing clean to wear. And he has a morbid fear of laundrettes.
Seems fair enough to me.
Which is, you know, something we've all suffered from it from time to time.
Absolutely.
So he hits his struggle to leave the house, basically. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the first pretty much half of the film, more than maybe, is Simon Pegg alone in his house going a bit bonkers. And it's absolutely riveting. It's a terrific performance from him. Absolutely
yeah.
great.
He's very, very brave as well. There's a sequence where he performs in his underpants, because he's pretty much exclusively in his underpants.
He spends a lot of time in his pants.
Yeah, and he performs gangster rap as well.
Yes.
It's quite a brave... He's prepared to be unlikable in this movie.
That was a brave move. I mean, as he said in the interview, you know, he just went for that. He just decided, right, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to be straight-faced about it. I'm not going to be embarrassed. Everyone else is going to be embarrassed for me. And yeah, sure enough, so you will be when you see this.
Yeah, but you know, I like this movie. I thought it was, you know, people will be expecting one thing from it. It's closer probably to Bunny and the Bull.
Yeah,
than it is
probably
anything else for the last 3 years or three, 4 years, whatever. It's pretty much like nothing Simon has ever done.
Definitely
I
different.
I would say as well.
And it's got little touches of animation, and in the second yeah. half it kind of takes a turn for something
yeah,
completely
it,
different.
Obviously it doesn't entirely always 100% work, but
no.
it is at times very off the wall. It is at times weirdly, darkly funny. I preferred the stuff where he's on his own in his flat.
Too.
There's some really nice moments in that. Once he gets to the laundrette, there's a decent sequence to the laundrette, and you know, towards the end it shifts, it changes position on the rails, shall we say, a little bit. But this is fine. I don't think it's going to be a movie that's going to change the world. You know, it's very much a sort of Star Trek is for me, Star Trek's for them rather. A Fantastic Fear of Everything, maybe for me, it's one of those very,
yeah.
very small, quirky films that you see, you know, comedians like this doing.
Yeah,
just to
very,
keep a hand
very
in the
personal
till.
Project, I think, yeah. for all involved. But I mean, it is really funny. I was amused consistently throughout.
Yeah. What would you make of Crispin Mills? I mean, he's been a rock sensation for many years now.
He has, and he's done you know, music videos and shorts
yeah.
and things like that. On the basis of this, I'd say he's definitely kind of one to watch. He could be a slightly almost like a homegrown Wes Anderson, but slightly weirder, possibly. Maybe headed in that direction.
Yeah,
it's kind of hard to say, but certainly it's a really good start.
So we get this 3 stars, which we always have to remind people this is a recommendation. 3 stars means good. So yeah, go and if you fancy it, go and check out Fantastic Fear of Everything. Thumbs up. It's one thumb up, 2 thumbs up. What are we talking here on the Ebert scale? 1.5 thumbs up.
One and a half thumbs. One thumb is crooked in the direction of being up, but not 100% extended.
It's not fully Maca aloft yet. Okay. Now let's move on to a film that Coop well see, The Last Hurrah of George Lucas, and Ian's pulling this advice because I'm a big fan of George Lucas. Red Tails tells the true story of the Tuskegee Airmen, a squadron of black fighter pilots, and their experiences fighting enemies both internal in the US Air Force and external, i.e. nasty Nazis, during World War II. Lucas has been trying to make this film for a quarter of a century. He ended up actually producing it himself and shooting the flying sequences while Anthony Hemingway of The Wire directed. Has it been worth the wait, Ian? 25 years?
Yeah, it kind of has. The flying sequences are terrific. There's about a good hour of boy's own flying stuff, and there's some, and he kind of makes them different, which is a very difficult thing to do. It kind of starts with they're taking down the munitions train, and then the Luftwaffe introduced this kind of jet plane that kind of spices things up a bit. So the flying stuff's really good. It's a very likable cast of most of the actors that I didn't know. David Ayolao turns up as the lead guy in it.
Yeah.
And it has its heart in the right place. So they're kind of the positives of it. The kind of the negatives of it is that it's such a terrific piece of source material that I'm not sure that making a boy's own children's adventure. He's basically done what he did with Star Wars. He's taken a 40s film and just updated it with some special effects.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that that's the best approach for this story. It's such a rich story. The kind of the trials and tribulations that these guys went through to get even just to get to the Air Force is so sort of dramatically compelling that I wonder they wouldn't be better doing that story.
That is the more interesting one, isn't
but
it?
But yeah, mm. I think they were talking about they didn't want to make a film about victims, and I get that, but it doesn't feel like you made the best movie from that material.
Mm. It's very on the nose, I think, was my main issue with it. You know how the first sequence where they're flying and the dialogue in the cockpits and they're talking, I was half expecting you to sort of pan out and there'll be a guy watching some kind of cheesy propaganda video and then the film starts, but no, this is actually the film.
It is, yeah. It is very much, you know, those kind of Howard Hawks 40s war movies, and the depiction of the Germans is hilarious.
Brilliant, isn't it?
It's hair flicking in an airplane.
He's German, he says evil things, and he has a scar, just in case there was any doubt at all that he's the villain.
Yeah.
I think, but I mean, I know you said you liked the air stuff. I was, be honest, I was a little disappointed with the dogfighting stuff. I think because obviously Star Wars was inspired by World War II dogfighting. But to my mind, there's nothing in this that really rivals the kind of X-Wing action you get in, say, Return of the Jedi. And I thought that was a bit of a shame for me.
I don't know. I thought, you know, considering there's so many effect shots in these movies these days that you expect some good ones, some brilliant ones, and some poor ones. And I think the level is pretty consistently very high across
yeah, I'd certainly know, convincing. The CGI was very convincing. I just, it didn't feel, you know, it didn't feel as dynamic as perhaps it could. Also, what were these planes shooting? You know, it's a World War II plane. It guns down that this boat. It's exploding. Every bullet seems to be sending sort of shock waves across the runway. It's just they clearly had access to secret ammunition. Am I picking holes now? Sorry.
You may be picking holes. Who knows? I thought it was cheesy, slightly clunky. In many ways, it does feel like a George Lucas movie.
In
the best possible way. You know, you can type the shit, but you sure can't say it.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because years ago, he used to bring in other writers to punch stuff up. People in Willard Hoyk and Gloria Katz to punch up Star Wars. He put Lawrence Kasdan to do the Star Wars sequels and Raiders. Mm. Yeah, he seemed to have a change in his career where he thought that this stuff isn't, you know, dialogue can just be functional. And that's what it is, it's functional dialogue.
Mm.
I don't know what happened to him where he decided that was okay to do that. And, you know, I was looking at some of the other lines of the summer and, you know, Avengers has got some clunky lines in it and The Raid is full of clunky lines.
Yeah.
If you want. So I think, you
well,
know,
if you
George,
heard them in the original Indonesian.
Maybe not. But if you kind of, you know, if you want to hit George with that dialogue stick, which I get, you know, there are other people that can be hit with that stick as well.
Prometheus,
yeah,
also.
I do get you. I mean, the cast is likeable. Mm. And I think the movie doesn't entirely work for me, but the performances are strong enough. And Cooper Gooding Jr., Terrence Howard, who are kind of flitting in and out as
superiors to the
Tuskegee Airmen, are just solid.
Yeah,
they're solid. But I wouldn't say it's the greatest movie ever made. But it's Lucas's swan song.
It is, yeah, and it's looking even more that way. If in the news this week, you saw that Kathleen Kennedy has joined Lucasfilm as co-chairman, which is the strongest kind of affirmation we've had that he is actually going to be stepping down. Mm. And I think it's weird because Kathleen Kennedy, produced with Steven Spielberg, is somebody who does care about writing, and that'd be interesting to see what kind of influence she has on the movies.
Does this mean? Do you think that this means that Lucasfilm are going to step it up as a production company? Because
I do, yeah, because I don't think she'd go into it without that sort of agenda. Mm. I also think, whether you like this or not, I think it'll put Indy 5 back firmly on the agenda. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, Crystal Skull made $800 million.
So, biggest one yet.
Yeah, so you're, if you're, from a business point of view, you'd be mad to not put that on your slate. So I think that will probably happen. But I think she'll do interesting things. She'll mix it up. So there'll be tons of different projects from Lucasfilm, I think, with her.
Because we had Rick McCallum on the podcast last week, who's a fascinating guest, and I put the question to him that, surely George Lucas, who's a man who's worth $3.2 billion, can make any movie he wants at any time. But it doesn't quite work that way, apparently.
It doesn't seem to. And he's always talked about these private little personal little films he's going to make. And I don't really understand why he hasn't made them yet. But that's what he's going to go off and do. And you know, good luck to him if he does that.
I think it might be like Peter Jackson immediately following Lord of the Rings. He's built up this monster machine around him to make the big films and has to kind of keep feeding it, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll see. It'll be interesting times.
Absolutely. But Red Tails, we gave 3 stars.
3 stars, yep.
Absolutely. So again, that is a recommendation. Would you say this is maybe one more for DVD, or do you think this is a cinema experience for people?
Well, I think with the flying sequences, you want to see it on the biggest screen you can.
Okay, Crispy Mills isn't the only music star turning to directing this week. Ben Drew, a.k.a. Plan B, has also stepped behind the camera with Ill Manners, a fiercely personal hip-hop musical depicting the hardships of life on a council estate. So what do you make of this one, Helen? Because this sounded to me, when I first heard about it, that it could be roughly akin to Tyrannosaur, but with musical numbers.
Yeah, the musical thing is kind of weird. Basically what happens is there are 6 interlocking stories, and the sort of the backstory on most of those people is given by a narrator who basically raps the story. So that's kind of, it's not like there's dance numbers or anything, which, to be honest, is kind of a shame. I would kind of love to have seen a really gritty hip-hop musical done that way. I think it could be brilliant.
Yeah.
But this isn't quite that. It kind of, you know, touches on musical territory, but doesn't go there.
But the music is Plan B's new material.
Yeah, yeah.
Performed by him, or is it performed by someone else?
I believe mostly performed by him. There's some, you know, guest stars coming in.
So lip-synced by people. Or does he appear in the film?
Oh, no, he doesn't appear. No, it's just, it's narration. It's rap narration,
basically.
Oh, so it's
literally that. Okay, narration. And it's very uncompromising, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, basically all the characters are, you know, there's the drug dealers, there's their sort of minions, there's the gangster, there's the crack whore, there's the woman forced into prostitution.
It's like the worst game of Cluedo ever.
It's not a cheery group of people, I'll be honest. I mean, the sort of saving grace is there's a couple of little touches of kind of comedy and light relief in there, you know, it's not completely devoid of that. And you've also got Riz Ahmed as the sort of most likeable character of the lot. He plays Aaron, who's a kind of minor figure in the drug scene. And he's about as close as we get to a hero, and even he is not exactly what you call heroic. So it's pretty unrelenting. Uh-huh. But I think for a first film made on about 50p and a packet of crisps,
it's part of the microwave scheme,
yeah,
which makes movies for budgets under £100,000. This movie cost less than £100,000.
Well, what I can say is they've put the money where they needed it. You know, they've got great photography. It looks incredible. It looks really, really classy. And it looks like it costs a lot more than that. And while the cast is mostly unknown, they're all really good. And I think it's to Drew's credit, really, that he's got together a cast of, you know, in large part, non-actors, and gotten really good performances out of them. I just would have liked to have seen something a little bit less grim and a little bit maybe more kind of nuanced. But, you know, that's not where he's coming from, hey?
Absolutely. But he does seem to be focusing on movies these days. I mean, he's going to be in The Sweeney later in the year as an actor. And he's a good actor. He's been in the likes of he's in Harry Brown, most notably. And he's very, very solid in that. And he strikes me as one of those people who's rather sickeningly brilliant at everything he does.
I think he might be. I think he's, you know, this is the start of something. I mean, for a first feature, this is really, really impressive. And just the way it's been put together, because he wrote it as well. So just the technically, to make this kind of multi-layered, multi-moving part story kind of function, I think is really, really good work on his part. So, yeah, a really good sign of things to come. I mean, you know, as you're probably gathering, it's not entirely my cup of tea, because I tend to avoid totally grim stories about East London, because I live in East London, I don't need it.
I mean, it is totally grim.
But at the same time, as such stories go, this is a really well-told one.
We should probably apologise to the people of East London. It's not entirely grim.
It's not. I live there. Many parts are nice. It's
I've just, been there,
you know,
many times, and so far I've not
You're
been
still
stabbed.
Alive.
I'm still alive, so we're doing well. We'll see how we're doing next week, though. And we gave this a 3 stars. This is very much a 3-star a week.
It is a bit of a 3-star week, which is always a bit disappointing. You want to go a bit more extreme at either end, but sometimes, you know, they're all that kind of quite good but with some reservations kind
Absolutely.
Of films.
Also out this week's Will Ferrell curio Casadima Padre, which is a spoof of Mexican telenovelas and comes to us entirely in Spanish. It's funny in parts but uneven. We gave it just 3 stars. There's also Ty West's excellent horror film The Innkeepers, and of course Bob Whitey's fascinating documentary about Woody Allen entitled Woody Allen, a Documentary. We gave both of these 4 stars. Ian, you reviewed Woody Allen, a Documentary, so what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, It's a terrific look at Woody's life and his career. Bob Whitey's had terrific access to him. There's great stuff of him at home. There's stuff of him on set. Yeah. There's brilliant sort of archive footage as well, especially of him as a stand-up comic. There's a great scene where he's on television boxing a kangaroo. You should absolutely have to see that. And you know, well, it isn't a fantastic piece of documentary filmmaking. It's not rewriting the rules of documentary. And if you are a Woody buff, you'll have probably heard a lot of it before. But I think just to see the clips, to see the archive, and to get some sort of little gems into his life, I think, you know, it's terrific.
Well, just to see Woody Allen being Woody Allen, but really comfortable in front of a camera, was surprising to me, because this is a man who's very, very private, very, very shy off camera, and suddenly he was letting Whitey and his cameraman into his bedroom and showing him his stack of, you know, unused script ideas that he apparently stores under his bed.
Yeah,
which I thought was phenomenal.
And they get absolute access to everybody. They get Martin Scorsese, Diane Keaton, everybody you'd want to speak to about Woody speaks about Woody. And there's a great bit towards the end where Owen Wilson is talking about the success of Midnight in Paris, and he sort of compares Woody Allen to Michael Bay, which is like the only time in cinema that's ever happened. So.
I'd love to see Woody Allen's Transformers. I'd love to see that.
Yes.
And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, which is actually a catchphrase that originated with you, Ian.
It did.
I should pay you for that.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not going to. Anyway, goodbye from Helen.
Goodbye.
Okay, thank you. I took me by surprise. I don't know why. Goodbye from James.
Adios, senor.
Oh, very good. And goodbye for the first time, not the last time, hopefully, from Ian.
Stay classy, Empire Podcast. You have to make an Anchorman reference on this program, don't you? So I thought I was.
Anchorman and Avengers, I think we've covered all the bits.
You still owe us cake from that week that we didn't mention Anchorman, and you promised you'd give us cake if we didn't.
Right, it will be chocolate cake all around next week.
Excellent.
Well, I think we owe him royalties for the join us next week for more film-related fun. So anyway, join us next week for more film-related fun. That's another 50p. Goodbye from me.